please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, we send our peace and blessings upon all the prophets of Allah, Subhanahu wa Taala. And especially the last of them, Muhammadul Mustafa and his progeny, and those companions who followed their path. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and welcome to another program of For a Better Life, here on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the psychological diseases that we might have within us and in our society, the culture that we live in, the modern society with its ideology of modernism and postmodernism. Too much concern for the unknown future will not help us. The extent of attention that one directs to the future or the present greatly affects one's spiritual well-being. As you can see, there is a connection between the physical body, the physical health, the mental health, and the spiritual well-being. There are some people who give an extraordinary importance to the future. As a result, they miss the opportunity to benefit from the present. And that is something that we should have in our minds daily. Right now, I'm here in the radio station talking to you guys, brothers and sisters. I should not have my mind in another place. I should concentrate on the now, what we call the power of now. By doing so, we can raise the quality of everything we do. I would like to repeat what I said one more time. When we give extraordinary importance to the future, as a result, we miss the opportunity of the present. Even if no danger should threaten us presently, we are afraid that some unpleasant accident may befall us. We are overwhelmed by a fear which is as strong as we would feel in the face of a real danger. But guess what, dear brothers and sisters? That danger is not here. That danger is not a reality. That danger has not yet arrived. That danger might never arrive. That danger might not even be a danger. You presume it as a danger, but in fact, that thing might be something positive that you are thinking negatively about. So we are afraid that some unpleasant accident may befall us, and we fear it. And that fear is as strong as it would feel in the face of real danger. However, one must remember that the past has no influence on the present, and the future, too, is unforeseeable. The future events that should make one worried and concerned are those which are definite. But it goes without saying that such events turn out according to one's forecasts. Now, this is important.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
It goes without saying that such events are few, and rarely do events turn out according to one's forecast. Thus, do not think that that thing or that obstacle will happen. You might think it is negatively, but it might not be negatively. It might be something completely positive. So when your mind is flying away, take it back. Return your mind again and again and again. Do not let it fly away. Do not allow it to fly away. For example, sometimes we think about our grandmother and we end up with somewhere in the islands of the Maldives. Why is it like that? So we have to have what we call muraqabah, self-watchfulness. And muraqabatul adhan. Muraqabatul adhan, the watchfulness of the mind, or what we could call mindfulness. So when you are watching yourself, watching your deeds and watching your thoughts, you are having mindfulness. A scholar by the name of William John Rayleigh, he wrote, if you reflect, you will see that amongst your friends and even within your own family, those who have a positive way of thinking fascinate you more than the others. You like to be with them most of the time. Of course, there are also those amongst them who create trouble and headaches for you. Those who have a positive way of thinking are happier, livelier, and more active. They get things done and make them work. They might make many mistakes, but then they have the capacity to acknowledge their mistakes and correct them. They have the determination to start all over again. They don't waste time worrying or getting upset over something that would never happen. In every 24 hours, about more than 20 million meteorites enter the Earth's atmosphere. But there is no reliable record of any person getting killed anywhere due to the falling of any of those meteors. Thus, dear brothers and sisters, think about it for a moment. When you are with someone who is positive all the time, you enjoy being with that person. But imagine being with those negative people who always are what we call energy vampires. Energy vampires, negative people who spread negativity to others and poison. You usually do not like to be with those people, and they usually affect themselves, first of all, and affect others by complaining and nagging. And they are usually very unsuccessful people and very unhappy people. So if we do not want to be like them, we should make some drastic changes in our life. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. So all I need. So all I need. All I need.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we looked at how the ongoing epidemic of men's violence in America is rooted in this inability as a society to move beyond outmoded ideals of manhood. In a sweeping analysis that cut across racial, ethnic, and class lines, we examined mass shootings, day-to-day gun violence, violence against women, bullying, and American militarism against the backdrop of a culture that has normalized violent and regressive forms of masculinity in the face of challenges to traditional male power and authority. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
It turns out that Lord Baden-Powell founded the Boy Scout for a very explicit reason, to counteract what he perceived as a decline in the manly virtues. In his influential book, Rovering to Success, A Guide to Young Manhood, Powell was quite explicit about this. God made men to be men, he wrote. Civilization, with its town life, buses, hot and cold water laid on, everything done for you, tends to make men soft and feckless beings. We badly need training for our lads if we are to keep up manliness in our race instead of lapsing into a nation of soft, sloppy cigarette suckers.
The Scout program is designed to help our sons, cousins, and younger brothers develop the initiative, the resourcefulness, the character, the quick thinking, and the leadership they really need in the somewhat jittery, insecure world in which we live.
Again and again at key moments in American history, you see men reacting to change in just this way by retreating into a hyper-masculine fantasy world. You see it in the rise of popular men's magazines in the 1940s, filled with stories about breathtaking manly adventures in sports. These magazines may look retro to us today, but what's important to remember is that they were just as retro in their own time. As the lives of men grew more sedentary during the consumer boom of the post-war years, as women moved into the workplace in unprecedented numbers and the women's movement gained traction, these magazines offered men a way to hit back at what Ralph Day, the editorial director of True Magazine, describes as the perils of creeping equality. Men were turning to his magazine in unprecedented numbers, Day explained to a group of men in a speech, because it stimulates his masculine ego at a time when man wants to fight back against women's efforts to usurp his traditional role as head of the family. This backlash has only accelerated exponentially since the 1960s, when the civil rights movement, the women's movement, and the anti-war movement rose up to challenge traditional masculine authority like never before, especially the authority of straight white men.
Plain
damn truth of the matter is this has to stop, and it has to stop like the day before yesterday.
Feminism was established so that unattractive, ugly broads could have easy access to the mainstream, right? Did you see it? Yes!
Look at our political culture, where the game is all about establishing your manly credentials by butching yourself up and methodically feminizing and taking apart the manhood of your opponents.
And to those critics who are so pessimistic about our economy, I say, don't be economic girly man.
There was no clearer depiction of this backlash phenomenon than the film Fight Club. The movie portrayed the emasculation of young men by the consumer culture.
We're still men.
Yes, we're men. Men is what we are.
And offered up bare-knuckled violence as a way for men to reclaim their manhood. Regardless of whether we see film as a glamorization or a satire of backlash masculinity, backyard fight clubs have proliferated in the years since the film's release. And at the base of all of this is the belief that the best way for men to restore their dwindling manhood and restore order is through what the cultural historian Richard Slotkin has called the frontier myth of regenerative violence.
Most people understand that guns make you safer, especially because society is degenerating. There's going to be a lot of craziness going on. And so we need guns to protect ourselves.
To older working and middle-class white men, the message is clear.
That's the thing that gets me. If I lived on the border and some brown man came running through my backyard that looks like he didn't belong there, then why aren't people doing that?
The basic idea is that the best way to regain power and control is through a barrel of a gun, or as many guns as possible.
They're accurate. Mm-hmm. They are dependable.
Yes, they are. Super dependable.
They are extremely well-made. You can carry plenty of them on your person at all times.
This white male paranoia and siege mentality have fueled the increasingly aggressive effort to block even the most sensible gun policies.
When the system is overwhelmed, and I mean the system on the entire planet, somebody had better be prepared to protect themselves, their families, their neighborhoods, and the freedom of all mankind. Never let them take your Second Amendment right, ever.
This siege mentality has also fueled the rise of hate groups and militias over the past quarter century.
They're not branches of Al-Qaeda. They're right-wing extremists with lots of guns and an axe to grind against the U.S. government.
Listen, people. Things are bad. Things are real bad. And it's going to get a lot worse. So basically, if people need to wake up, start buying some of these, see?
Groups like these are often described as white supremacist hate groups, which they usually are. But they can also be seen as a kind of reactionary men's movement, an organized expression of white male anxiety and aggrieved entitlement that relies on violence as the preferred means of attaining its goals.
Recovery crews are still searching the waters around an island where a gunman opened fire on young people attending a summer camp.
In recent years, perhaps the most disgusting and morally bankrupt expression of this kind of threatened entitlement was the massacre of 77 people, including 69 teenagers, perpetrated by the Norwegian right-wing fanatic Anders Breivik, a former customer service representative who had been declared unfit for service in the Norwegian army. In his 1,500-page manifesto explaining his reasons for the attack, Breivik ranted against culturalism, but he reserved special venom for feminism's role in emasculating Western men. According to Breivik, feminist ideology and political correctness have been responsible for transforming a patriarchy into a matriarchy and intend to deny the intrinsic worth of males. And by now, men have been reduced to an emasculated, touchy-feely subspecies. What this shows is that a whole lot of men out there fear they're losing control and are turning to violence to reclaim their manhood. In his fascinating study of violence, the psychiatrist James Gilligan interviewed hundreds of violent criminals in American prisons and found that the single most powerful reason they turned to violence was because they felt shamed, humiliated, or disrespected as men. The more time I spent with him, Gilligan writes about one of the hundreds of violent criminals he has interviewed over the course of his research, the clearer it became that his character served as a defense against the threat of being treated with scorn and disrespect, of being perceived as a weakling, not a real man, someone who could be laughed at. We may not hear about it much in mainstream coverage of violence, but again and again we've seen exactly this dynamic. Young men using violence to overcome the shame of not being seen and respected as real men.
16-year-old Luke Woodham entered the Commons area of Pearl High and fired off several shots.
Woodham opened fire at Pearl High School, killing two students.
Consider Luke Woodham, who carried out a school shooting in Pearl, Mississippi in the late 1990s. Woodham wrote a letter before he went on his rampage explaining himself this way. I am not insane, I am angry. I killed because people like me are mistreated every day. All throughout my life, I was ridiculed, always beaten, always hated. If I can't do it through pacifism, if I can't show you through the displaying of intelligence, then I will do it with a bullet. Murder is not weak and slow-witted. Murder is gutsy and daring.
Just minutes after firing two fatal shots at the Virginia Tech dormitory on Monday, Cho Sung-hui returned to his own dorm room and made the final preparations to mail what appears to be a video confession.
Or consider Sung-hee Cho, who committed one of the worst mass shootings in American history when he went on a shooting spree at Virginia Tech University in 2007, killing 32 people. Cho was a socially isolated, troubled young man with a history of mental health problems who had clearly bought into a cultural narrative that says the way to reclaim manhood is through projecting an image of menace and toughness, instilling fear in others, and using violence. Before he committed the Virginia Tech massacre, he wrote, produced, and starred in his own video, demonstrating how thoroughly he'd bought into this Hollywood script. Cho isn't the only mass murderer whose violent actions enabled him to rewrite the script of his life in order to place himself back in the manly starring role.
All you hear is like firecrackers, and then I looked out the window and there's a kid with a trench coat and a shotgun throwing pipe bombs in the parking lot.
The Columbine killers, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, left behind written diaries that provide insight into how their murder of 12 classmates and a teacher was part of a conscious strategy to settle scores. In his journal, Klebold writes that he and Harris will take revenge on society.
The shooter was 36-year-old Andrew Engeldinger, an employee of the small company who had recently lost his job.
And this isn't just about young men. Again and again, we've seen the same thing with older men who commit mass shootings.
A troubled ex-husband is under arrest in the Southern California hair salon shooting that left 8 people dead.
In case after case, these men have faced grief, bitter disappointment, and feelings of failure.
The shooter, Richard Farley, was obsessed with a female colleague. He had also been laid off.
They are either chronically unemployed, have been left by their wives or girlfriends, been fired from their jobs, or have suffered some other kind of serious blow to their self-worth as men. Nothing can excuse the pathetic and cowardly way men like these use violence and destroy the lives of innocent people to make some kind of a statement. But we're kidding ourselves if we think these killings will stop unless and until we can identify and transform the larger cultural belief systems that underlie them.
From the mass shooting in Tucson aimed at former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords to the Colorado movie theater massacre, killers in many recent mass killings suffered mental illness.
Of course, there's no question that mental illness has played a role in a lot of rampage killings and mass shootings. But what never seems to get discussed is why it is that somewhere around 98% of school shootings and rampage killings have been committed by men, even though there are plenty of young women who suffer from mental illness as well. What this tells us is that violence can't be reduced to mental illness on its own, especially since the vast majority of mentally ill people are not violent at all. The bottom line is that even men who are mentally ill live and operate within a culture that has normalized violent masculinity and defined manhood in exceedingly narrow ways.
It's been widely reported school shooter Adam Lanza suffered some kind of personality disorder.
The Sandy Hook Elementary school shooter Adam Lanza may have been mentally ill, but he played out a familiar script.
He was bullied severely, brutally bullied, when he was in elementary school at Sandy Hook.
By all accounts, he was a socially awkward boy who didn't fit in and appears to have been mercilessly bullied.
That's a clip of the video game Call of Duty. It's also the game that Adam Lanza used to play.
He developed a revenge fantasy, secured firearms, and then killed his own mother before carrying out one of the most brutal and ruthless mass killings in American history. And, in his own delusional and twisted way, he would recapture the sense of respect that seemed to have eluded him his whole life. The children of Newtown, like so many other innocent victims of men's violence, became theatrical props in the performance of an aggrieved, angry, and likely self-hating young man who absorbed all the wrong lessons about what it means to be a tough, strong man from the world around him. Just take a look at the ad campaign the Bushmaster Firearms Company ran prior to the Newtown massacre for the very AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle Lanza used during his killing spree. What all this amounts to is that our violence problem seems to be a lot less about lone wolves and monsters who fail to conform to society's norms than it is about too many men, in a sense, over-conforming to our norms and ideals of manhood out of fear of not being seen as men. When we talk about men's violence and dominant ideals of violent masculinity, there's a temptation to frame things in terms of the damage men do to others. But we need to look also at the devastating harm these norms do to men themselves. This is certainly true of gun violence. Every year in this country, over 30,000 people are killed by guns, something like 85 per day. The vast majority of these victims are men, approximately 86%. But while we're used to thinking about gun violence in terms of mass shootings and urban crime, we really don't talk a lot about how most gun deaths are the result of men and boys shooting themselves. Suicide, which is really violence turned inward, accounts for close to two-thirds of all gun deaths. The vast majority of people who kill themselves with a gun are men, and white men comprise over 80% of these firearm suicides. Violence doesn't just leave physical scars. It also leaves emotional scars. Look at the cost to African-American boys and young men of living in and around violence. Violence is the leading cause of death of African-American men between the ages of 15 and 30. But they also have much higher than average rates of depression, school dropout, mental health problems linked to perpetual stress, substance abuse. And just look at the terrible toll violence has taken on the psyches of men who serve in combat zones.
In the 5 years between 2006 and 2009, more than 1,100 members of the armed services took their own lives.
Something like half of U.S. service members who have done tours in Iraq and Afghanistan have signs of trauma, depression, flashbacks, alcohol and drug problems. In her landmark study, Trauma and Recovery, Judith Herman draws a powerful connection between the experience of male combat veterans and women who are the victims of domestic and sexual violence. The sources of the violence and their context might vary, but the unifying theme is that human beings, young and old, women and men, suffer when their physical and sexual boundaries are violated. But in the case of men, this pain gets compounded by a cultural belief system that equates manhood with invulnerability and ridicules and shames men who admit to being in emotional pain. In his classic work, I Don't Want to Talk About It, the therapist Terry Real identifies the widespread phenomenon of what he calls covert depression, a condition that roughly three-quarters of American men suffer in silence out of fear of seeming like less than a real man. For many of these men, childhood trauma and other experiences of violence play a role in this depression, which then can affect not only their ability to take care of themselves physically and emotionally, but also hinder their ability to sustain healthy relationships in adult life. Despite predictable arguments that equate trying to understand or prevent violence with weakness, the bottom line is that we have to have the strength to ask these kind of questions if we want to move beyond the never-ending cycle of violence. And that starts with examining the dominant stories we tell ourselves as a culture about manhood and violence and demanding more honest and accurate representations of the personal and societal consequences of violent masculinity. War movies like Saving Private Ryan showed not only the awe-inspiring courage of the men who stormed the beaches in Normandy and fought totalitarianism during World War II, the film also captured the panic, anxiety, and sheer terror of the young men who experienced that war.
There's too many locks. There's too many. I can't do it. I can't get it off. I'm sorry, okay? You understand? I'm sorry.
More recently, The Hurt Locker explored another devastating effect of battlefield trauma. Showing how the intensity and violence of war make it difficult for many veterans to adjust back to civilian life. And we saw the same kind of honest and tragic portrayal of dominant masculinity in the film The Wrestler, starring Mickey Rourke as an over-the-hill professional wrestler whose body was ravaged by physical injury and who was so emotionally damaged by violence that he couldn't imagine life outside the glamour of the arena. Intensely realistic shows like HBO's The Wire have refused to glamorize urban street life and violent crime, directly confronting the costs young men of color too often pay for their investment in the idea that respect comes only at the business end of a Glock. And we've seen emotionally complex shows like The Sopranos, which centered on brutal mob boss Tony Soprano, a ruthless killer who intimidated everyone around him, but also portrayed him as a deeply troubled man who had recurring panic attacks and who had to battle his own anxiety and self-doubt when he turned to a woman therapist for help.
Whatever happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type? That was an American. He wasn't in touch with his feelings. He just did what he had to do. See, what they didn't know was once they got Gary Cooper in touch with his feelings, that they wouldn't be able to shut him up. And then it's dysfunction this, and dysfunction that, and dysfunction...
And then there's Good Will Hunting, which catapulted Matt Damon to fame, with Damon playing the role of an intellectually gifted working-class tough guy who relieves the trauma of his abusive childhood by hardening himself to the world and fighting anyone who challenges him. With the support of a woman who loves him and a therapist he comes to trust, finds the courage to battle through his defenses, look inside himself, and let go of his bottled-up rage. After the Newtown Massacre, there was a lot of tough guy talk about how the cure for our violence problem is yet more violence.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
But there were other men who spoke in the wake of Newtown as well. Men like Neil Heslin, whose six-year-old son Jesse was among the 20 children gunned down that tragic day.
He was my son, he was my buddy, he was my best friend.
What was so important about his testimony was that he went beyond expressing grief for his son and directly challenged the culture of violence. Too often we define masculine strength by who can blow away the most people, who can flex the most muscle, who can impose their will and inflict the most damage. But this cheapens the real definition of strength and toughness. We respect the toughness of firefighters who rush into burning buildings when others are rushing out, police officers and other first responders who put their lives on the line, not because they're out to prove something, but because they steel themselves in the face of danger and face down their fears in service to others. For the same reason, we should respect the toughness and strength of men who challenge the myth that being a real man requires putting up a false front, disrespecting others, and engaging in violent and self-destructive behavior. Strength is about adapting to change, not about retreating from it and lashing back with violence out of fear. And it's high time we had a definition of manhood capable of meeting that challenge.
Well, the program helped to diagnose the root causes of America's increasing levels of hypermasculinity, bullying, and gun violence, as well as the correlation between violence and manhood. But it seems that changing this culture, which is rooted so deeply in grotesque models of violence, is easier said than done. That's it for this week. Do join us next week here on Aperture. Until another Aperture, it's goodbye.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise the children Islamically. We have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, dear Sister Salma Khalfan.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me over.
You're welcome. So we'll start off with our first question. There's a question saying that how do we abstain from domestic quarrels at home, and what effect does it have on children, on their upbringing? And later on, it even asks, how do we even avoid these conflicts?
Yeah. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Domestic quarrels are something that is very common in every home. But of course, it depends on how much it is, like how far it has been taken to. Mm-hmm. If it's just a normal quarrel that can be reformed easily, and it wouldn't lay a very bad impact on the child. Mm-hmm. But of course, it doesn't mean that it should not be avoided. All but right. Yes, abstaining from these domestic differences is of paramount importance for the upbringing of the child, especially the Islamic upbringing of the child.
Okay.
So that the psyche is pure and untainted and the potentials are exposed. The mm-hmm. way Allah has given us this amanat, right? Mm. A child, our children. So if we taint them, one of the ways of tainting them is through these quarrels, domestic quarrels, because it can really affect them badly in the long run.
Okay.
Even when they're adults, they won't forget such scenes. It won't be erased in their minds.
Mm. But then, as you say, the quarrels are always there in life, like ups and downs and stuff. So can you elaborate a bit more on exactly like you know, how the thing is to, till where can you say, okay, they're just normal corals and not like...
Yeah, we'll come to that later.
Okay.
But for now, I want to explain about why is it so significant for a child to be, you know, like in an atmosphere that is very peaceful with no corals,
okay,
no loud noises, you know. Even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us in the Holy Quran, "Inna ankara al-aswat la sawt al-hamir," the worst of the sounds is the sound of a donkey.
Mm-hmm.
So like loud voices and, you know, quarreling and everything really affects the child, especially if the child is like just born and he will be adapted to that kind of lifestyle, which has a very detrimental effect on his psyche, his emotions, his even physical well-being.
I guess if you go and see, it even has an effect on the older people, let alone the kids.
That's right, yeah. Absolutely. So what about the kids, right? They're so fragile and delicate. So, of course, first come the kids, and here we're talking about Islamic upbringing, so we need to lay emphasis on the kids. So for a child, the home is like a nest, you know. He feels very much attached to it. His heart is always tied to this nest. And if the parents themselves are on friendly terms with each other, and, of course, with the children around them, then this nest remains durable, like a warm lap. It becomes stronger and stronger as days go by. But the child feels, you know, in such a home, the child feels contented and secure.
Okay.
These are the effects of the nest, the warm lap.
Mm.
You know, he gets an upbringing in such an atmosphere that his capabilities are, you know, truly expressed.
Yes.
The way he's born with those capabilities that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has granted and bestowed upon him. And it'll have a very great results. His potential will be really actualized in a very beautiful manner.
Okay, dear listeners, let's take a break. Stay tuned and don't go away. We'll be back soon.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Yes, Sister Salma Khafan, we were talking on the effects that that the domestic corals have on the children, and that it's very significant to have like a very peaceful atmosphere for the kids, because it can have really detrimental effects. Yes,
that's right. So if the parents are always fighting and they're excitable, then the children will lose his calm and contentment, and they will always be uneasy and restless.
Okay.
Now, I recall in my extended family, very far off, I saw a child in her childhood.
Okay.
And she was a very cute and pretty child,
mm-hmm.
you know. And, but when I saw her after a few years, I saw a bad sulk on her face, a pretty face. And I was surprised, why is this sulk always there when you even try to, you know, laugh with the child? The sulk is always there. And then I came to know that there were domestic quarrels, a lot of domestic quarrels in the house. And that brought that sulk in her face. And now this child is also married. But you see that however she tries to portray herself, but the sulk is there.
It just breaks the child down, isn't
it? Just breaks the child down. And there's so many detrimental effects that we, inshallah, are going to talk about. So these are the effects physically even seen, you know.
Yeah.
We are surprised that
so that's just physical, but then what
so
they
what
have
about
inside
the emotional?
Circle, yeah.
It must be like a completely, you know, she must be a very bothered child, yeah. So the parents who argue and fight do not realize that the feelings of the poor child in such a situation gets frightened. She gets frightened and hurt. In fact, the child begins to feel actually that it's probably her fault. Or even she feels that just now the bang will go on her, you know?
And somehow, I guess they're pushed away when, you know, the parents are always fighting and quarreling with each other. So they're not given that attention as well.
Of course, of
course. So I guess that would be the
reason. They're pushed away as well, and they're not paid attention to the way they're supposed to. And in fact, you know, this shows that how selfish the parents are, right? How selfish nature they are, that they don't think about their child.
Yeah.
That
scene.
And you see other parents on the other side, they're so smart that they go in their rooms and they talk about the matter. So they are both sides.
Yeah, because corals are always there. So in order to sort them out, there should be some different ways.
Of course, there should be a
privacy.
You shouldn't do it for, yeah, there should be an area where you can't talk openly to the child.
Yeah.
Even if he's a big child. you know, of about matured level child, like, for example, 12, 13-year-old, mm-hmm. it's very much more advisable not to talk it out.
Yeah.
You know, I remember there was a family whose parents, whose mother was sick and tired of the spouse, and she said that she told the son that I'm going to divorce your father. She thought that she's so smart mm-hmm. because the son is like maybe 15-year-old, he would mm-hmm. understand. But he started crying oh. and saying that, please don't take a divorce. Where will I be at this point in time? So there are many detrimental effects.
This yeah, is, as when, I go along, when mother and the father are together, they feel that warmth.
That nest, yeah, yeah, that nest of security, said, yeah. and they feel protected. So there are many experiences I would like to state so that we can have a clearer picture mm. of when parents do like this, what happens to the children as they grow up. And that's how we'll outline what happens, you know, like in the long run, how the effects come about in a child in the long run.
Yeah.
So they also, you know, try to hide themselves in a corner. And, you know, they wonder also why the parents are behaving in such a manner while the adults, while the mother is having a role of taking care of the child, nursing the child.
Yeah.
So the child feels, my mother is everything to me. And then suddenly he sees this, you know, like a quarrel,
yeah.
a quarrelsome manner, and he gets very frightened, and he becomes, you know, like his mind goes wayward, that what is this? The good and bad mixed together,
yeah.
you know?
Okay, we'll continue after the break. Stay tuned, dear listeners. We'll be back soon.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Yes, Sister Khalfan. We were talking about the contentment that a child has when the parents don't fight in the house, and that they get agitated and they, you know, lose that peace and calm in their hearts, and they feel disturbed.
Are,
yes,
that's right. These are the consequences of what happens to a child. They seek avenues of fleeing from this nest, this warm lap, and which has been so dear for them, like a mother. I told you, he thinks now there are two sides of a mother, the good and the bad, you
know? So it breaks that picture, the good picture that they had of the mother or the father.
Yeah.
Then it kind of changes somebody whom they looked up to, and now it's not the same person. So it kind of, it's very difficult, I think, for the child.
And then, you know what, he seeks solace in the bazaar. The people outside, his friends, who would show their best to, you know, not the real picture, not the reality. I mean, friends are friends in the long run, but who will be of, you know, like use in for you, you know, in the long run?
Because friends
it'll be just
and
parents and family, right?
True, yes.
And however much a mother and father do like such behavior, they have fights and everything, you'll see still their heart loving and longing for the child.
True.
But
yes.
the child will have separated from their heart, from his heart towards his parents. He will feel that insecurity, this frightful nature in him that'll take him even towards adulthood, because such memories never erase. It is said that a child, you know, always remembers memories that are like not at a personal level, but at a family and social level. Like if you give him a toy or a lollipop or a chocolate, this will probably erase from his mind. But that social get together, that when one praises the child in a social gathering, one, you know, like plays together, has fun together, excitable, you know, scenes and everything. This kind of memories never erase from a child. But and likewise, when memories like these come up, for example, when parents are fighting and the whole house is, you know, like blasting with loud noises.
True,
so this really makes the child ache inside.
Yeah.
And he will never forget that,
yeah,
you know, in the long run.
Yeah, exactly.
So the child is unable to forget such scenes the whole of his life. And the events remain etched on his psyche. And they have such detrimental effects on his nature also. And, you know, sadly, it'll affect his future relationships sometimes. And we will see such examples sometimes. I'm not saying all the time.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, you know, he feels that no family can be so perfect. And there doesn't exist a family like that. You know, it's like however we were brought up with, whatever kind of culture or habits we were brought up with, mm-hmm. and suddenly we see something performed in a different way, we feel, does it really exist? You know, let's ask ourselves about it, yeah? Does it really exist? It probably doesn't. It's just a myth or something. But this is how it happens to them, the children, yeah. They feel that such loud noises and fighting and quarreling nature is normal. So there doesn't exist a peaceful life, a peaceful father.
So they end up having the same
life. A peaceful wife, exactly, yeah. Mm. So they end up having the same, they follow the same pattern.
Yeah.
In fact, they follow the same pattern, which is more dangerous, right?
Or maybe even like sometimes even the parents, most of the times you can say the parents do it unintentionally, not knowing the effects that it has on the That's children. Right. And then it just goes on in generations of generations. Yes,
generations, you see. Yeah. Because it becomes a genetic makeup. So it's just
spoiling the whole generations.
Exactly. Like. So such akhlaq is very important in the parents. And it starts with the akhlaq. No?
Okay. Sister Khalfan, do you have more points to add up to this question?
Yes, lots of more points, inshallah.
So inshallah, we'll continue on in the next session, inshallah. So before we end up, I would just like to summarize. Sister Salam Khalfan, you talked about the detrimental effect the domestic quarrels have on the children, and that if they don't get their love and warmth and care and the peace at home, then they go outside looking for it. Inshallah, we'll continue in the next session. Thank you very much for joining us on this program. And dear audience, if you have any questions, any comments, any suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. And subscribe to our YouTube channel and Facebook page, Call of Islam Radio. Inshallah, till the next program, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned, perfect with no flaws at all, are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. Introduction to Islamic Lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, the world is a market. This world is neither man's main home nor his permanent residence. Rather, it is a great house of commerce to which man is sent. He is given a capital in the form of his lifespan, physical and mental powers, guidance and intelligence, so that he may use these to accumulate valuable provisions to take back for his eternal prosperity and everlasting life. Those who are active, diligent, vigilant, hardworking, and far-sighted know the tricks of this great commerce. They do not relent for a moment. They are always on the lookout for opportunities to trade their temporary worldly goods to earn precious heavenly goods, merchandise with an eternal shelf life and a bright destiny for themselves as well as their society. Unlike the losers, they do not spend their capital on futile, transitory, and destructive worldly pursuits, which result in leaving the world empty-handed. So there are two types of people. One are good investors, the other are not so good or poor investors. Poor investors invest their capital in poor investments. Those who are wise, those who are smart, those who are intelligent investors, they make sure that whatever they invest their capital in has to be result-bearing. And these are the believers. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the topic of the world is a market, and we are sent here with some capital. One of those capitals is our life. The other is our physical and mental powers, the guidance and intelligence. All of these are the capitals that we have been sent to this world with. Now, if we are smart and intelligent investors, we would know where to invest all this. But if we are out of those dumb ones, then rest assured we are going to waste this capital. Imam Hadi alayhi salam has said, "The world is a market in which some gain and some lose." Now again, brothers and sisters, who are those who gain and who are those who lose? Look at the history. Look at the lives of prophets and imams. Look at the guidelines and instructions of Quran. You would know where to invest your capital. At a macro level, there are three types of human beings. One considers this world to be everything and a permanent abode. The second type considers this world to be meaningless and don't work hard in this world. They simply waste their lives and resources and their capital. Number three, the third type knows the reality of this world and knows that they are not going to live here forever. Their souls belong to somewhere else. They have come from somewhere else and are headed towards somewhere else. These are the believers. They do not waste their capital, their time, their energies, their resources, their capabilities, their, you know, investments in this world on futile things. They are the ones who are God-weary, who know exactly where God wants them to spend their energies. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The world is curious about the future direction of the relationship between China and the United States. Tensions between the two major strategic rivals skyrocketed under former U.S. President Donald Trump. The former president seemed very proud of his tough line on the world's second largest economy. He launched a trade war against China and blamed it for starting the devastating COVID-19 pandemic. Now his successor, Joe Biden, is still reviewing America's strategy towards its number one rival. This week, he announced the Defense Department review of its China strategy as part of a broader effort to decide how his team will deal with Beijing. Now, a newly formed task force at the U.S. Department of Defense will study the military strategy regarding China in different areas. Biden does not seem to have any illusions about the formidable challenges posed by the Chinese. During his presidential campaign, he pledged to lead an international effort to pressure, isolate, and punish China. This week, in his first phone call with the Chinese President Xi Jinping, Biden tried to press his counterpart on several issues, including trade practices, Hong Kong, and ongoing tensions with Taiwan. The American president underscored his fundamental concerns, but the Chinese president told his U.S. counterpart that he hoped Washington would approach matters of sovereignty and territorial integrity cautiously. She warned that confrontation would be disastrous for both sides.
There is a significant lack of trust on the part of both sides. Nobody's going to rush into anything at this moment under pressing conditions. But if they can find some individual items in which they can cooperate, COVID obviously is one of the areas which are affecting both countries.
The United States has been trying hard to contain China in terms of economy and military power. Such efforts were intensified over the past years, but fulfilling that goal is proving to be increasingly difficult, with China's military might increasing and its economy expanding despite the pandemic that has battered the American economy. Some estimates show that China will overtake the U.S. and become the world's largest economy sometime in this decade. This is undoubtedly keeping the Americans on the edge. These concerns were echoed by U.S. President Joe Biden this week. During a meeting with a bipartisan group of senators soon after his phone call with the Chinese leader, Biden issued a stark warning. If we don't get moving, they're going to eat our lunch. Biden warned that the Chinese are investing very heavily to deal with a whole range of issues, including transportation and the environment. The American president said the U.S. just has to immediately step up infrastructure spending. How will Biden try to counter China? Is there any room left for cooperation? Chinese officials insist that there is still a possibility.
It's kind of a light at the end of what will probably be a very long tunnel if we are to repair the U.S.-China relationship. But I think that the statement made by President Biden in his foreign policy address, which was also pretty hard-hitting with regard to China, but nevertheless, he said that they will cooperate in those issues which are in the interest of the United States. And then, of course, the call on a very important, prior just to the a very important Spring Festival, I think sent a very good signal to the Chinese that maybe there was a way to create some kind of a new connection between the U.S. and China.
But will America move to reduce tensions? U.S. officials have said there would be no quick moves to remove tariffs on Chinese imports. The White House could even impose new targeted restrictions on sensitive technology exports to China. Experts say under Biden, the two sides will probably find a pathway to stabilize their relationship, but neither side will budge on key issues.
When former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, it also withdrew from any right of comment as to the ongoing agreement, meaning that in order for the U.S. to reconsider joining the accord, it must abide by the terms and conditions of the original plan and respect the wishes of the incumbent members. Yet with Donald Trump now out of the picture, current U.S. President Joe Biden has expressed an interest in rejoining the JCPOA, as demonstrated by his selection of advisors and foreign policy chiefs. However, Iran has warned the 46th president that the time frame for having the right to rejoin the table is fast running out as the window of opportunity tightens on the US. The Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, specified that certain events and circumstances in Iran meant that should the US not hasten its act in showing genuine intention of rejoining the JCPOA, it may find that the door firmly shuts behind it, leaving the US out of the cold when it comes to the agreement. And this was reiterated by Iranian President Hassan Rouhani.